Welcome to Little Atoms on Resonance 104.4 FM, a live talk show about ideas and culture, with an emphasis on ideas of the Enlightenment.
Little Atoms is presented by Neil Denny, Padraig Reedy, Richard Sanderson and Becky Hogg, as well as regular guest presenters.
Little Atoms actively promotes science, freedom of expression, scepticism and secular humanism.
Our guests bring ideas that are challenging, sometimes controversial, often polemical, but always interesting. Hello and welcome to Little Atoms. With me, Richard Sanderson, and with Padraig Reedy. I haven't been on for a long time, so you'll have to forgive me if I'm a bit rusty. But I'm delighted to say that we have our guest here with us, who's Nick Cohen, and Padraig's going to introduce him.
Nick Cohen is a columnist for The Observer. He also writes for Standpoint, The Spectator, and many other titles. He's the author of Cruel Britannia, Reports on the Sinister and the Preposterous, Pretty Straight Guys, What's Left, How the Left Lost Its Way, and Waiting for the Etonians, Reports from the Sickbed of Liberal England. His new book is You Can't Read This Book. Welcome, Nick.
Hello. Thanks for having me.
First of all, congratulations on a wonderful book. But we're going to start off and talk about someone else's wonderful book, because You Can't Read This Book is all about free expression and censorship. And this week, we have seen the return of the ugly controversy of the Satanic Verses at the Jaipur Literary Festival. Let's talk a little bit about that and the Satanic Verses controversy.
You can't get away from Rushdie. You were saying to me there are people in your office, you work in an anti-censorship organisation, who weren't even born when Satanic Verses was published. It became the defining controversy of our age, as the Dreyfus case was in the 1900s, because it redrew the map of the free world. Before the Ayatollah Khomeini issues his death threats against Rushdie for writing a blasphemous book, people, if you could make it to the West, if you could make it to democracy, you could write what you wanted. You were okay. You might not be okay in Iran or India or whatever, but you were okay there, and people thought they had a great amount of freedom. Suddenly, with bombs exploding in bookshops on the Charing Cross Road, with publishers being threatened with assassination, people suddenly realised that censorship had become globalised. There was nowhere to hide. You couldn't go to any country to escape this. And my book starts off with a reaction against that, which was brilliant at first. Everyone defended Rushdie's right to publish. The Satanic Verses, you can still buy it in the shops. But afterwards became immensely cowardly. No one since has imitated Salman. Mm-hmm. And also, if a young novelist, a young ex-Muslim novelist, were to go to a publisher with a book that criticised the Quran as a correct collection of fairy tales, quite grim fairy tales, and criticised Muhammad, no publisher would dare publish it.
Mm-hmm.
It just wouldn't happen. And for Salman, it just goes on and on and on and on and on. It's a battle between individual conscience and authority, which is timeless, but also a battle which always needs to be fought and always needs to be won.
Of course, the last controversy we saw about a book which not even provocatively questioned the life of Muhammad, very affectionately looked at the life of Muhammad, was Sherry Jones' book, The Jewel of Medina.
Oh, yeah. I'm a middle-aged man. I was really not its target audience. It's a historical romance for a woman readership. After I bought it on Amazon to research this book, I started getting Amazon suggested I read, Breeches on Fire or Bodices in Tatters and other great romantic novels. I mean, it is so nice, it is so sweet, but it's anything now. One reviewer said my book is that what it shows is, it's not that the bar's raised high or the bar's raised low. There is no bar. You don't know where the bar is. So people just steer away from subjects out of fear of provoking a response out of nothing.
I thought it was quite interesting that you actually got a quote from Grayson Perry, who is somebody the listeners to an arts radio station like Resonance would be familiar with. For those who aren't, he was a Turner Prize, certainly nominated.
Oh, great
Potter.
Artist.
And he had. What was his sort of line?
Well, I mean, Grayson does pottery. He's a very talented man. I mean, does pottery paintings, images of the Virgin Mary, which Catholics would doubtless find blasphemous. He says at one point in 2005, I think it was, he says, I don't do anything on Islam because I don't want to have my throat cut. But then he this statement of the obvious, because there's a great deal of cover up in British intellectual life, because all artists, all journalists like to pretend we're fearless truth seekers to power, we're transgressing boundaries, we're edgy, we take risks. Of course, when the risks have real consequences for us. We don't. So this statement of the obvious was so true, it was so rare, forgive me, that it became news in all the press. But then Grayson says something incredibly shrewd. He said, with other religions, you know where the limits are. But Islam, you don't. Mm-hmm. Now that is something, that's something very important. If, even in dictatorial states, if there are rules, you can press up against them or seek to subvert them. Some of the greatest cinema Europe produced in the second half of the 20th century was made under communist dictatorships. Poland, Czechoslovakia, think of Andrzej Wajda. Mm-hmm. You know, made fantastic films, far better than anything Hollywood produced. But it was still under a communist dictatorship. But because the dictatorship was no longer Stalinist, but quite moderate, he could push up against the boundaries and make films where the political message was just under the surface and the censors would let it through, they didn't quite understand, or maybe the censors were quite sympathetic. Once the rules go, you have random violence where you just don't know, where it makes no sense. Like I use the image of going postal in American mass murders. You know, the postal, some guy, normally a postal worker, no one ever knows why, goes into a school and just shoots dead a load of people. And when they try and find out why he did it, the reason is so tiny. Mm-hmm. He was upset when he was at school. He didn't like his teachers. It is out of all proportion. The reason is out of all proportion to the violence delivered. And you find that in dictatorships, both secular and religious. When they want to get really nasty, the violence is always is almost random. Mm-hmm. So the only safe course is to say nothing about politics. You do not grumble about a dictator in a shop queue. Mm-hmm. Because you can be arrested for that. You don't say anything about the taboos of a religion that is remotely critical, because you can be done for that. That is sensitive of an entirely different order from what people experience in stable, rather boring authoritarian regimes.
Mm-hmm. I mean, we're talking a bit about self-censorship as well.
Oh, yeah.
In that people are self-censoring what they're going to say. And this sort of brings up the whole idea of offence and respect. And there's, you talk about, really, the bankruptcy of the term respect, really.
Well, it's a very interesting term. I'm sorry if this argument is a bit theoretical. 300 years ago, no one said that they must defend their religion because they want it to be respected. They defended their religion because they thought it was the word of God and it was the truth. And I make the case of libel cases. You can sue for libel if someone has told lies about you that damage you, and you are upholding the truth when you sue for libel. Respecting religion, it comes from a world where even if believers are absolutely sincere, they now know something and have any education at all which our ancestors didn't know. They know that the most intelligent people in the world, the best theories of how the world is run, have no need for God, have no need for their religion. That a lot of people, very bright people, believe that the truth and religion are entirely distinct. So instead of being like someone suing for libel to defend the truth, they're more like celebrities mm-hmm. who bring privacy actions. Mm-hmm. Say, okay, what this newspaper tells me about, you know, hiring prostitutes by the half dozen to beat me in a London dungeon, or my wholesome image isn't reality. That might be right, but it's showing me disrespect. You should not say that about me, even if it is totally right. And this idea is the idea that you respect religions. I mean, the crass answer, not crass answer, the simple answer is to say, why on earth should I respect a woman that, religion that mandates subjugation of women or the murder of homosexuals or anti-Semitism or the inquisitorial state? That's not respectable. That's one level. But another level to this is to say, hold on a second, respect for religion and toleration of religion are entirely different things. Toleration allows argument. Toleration allows you to proselytise for your faith, Rich to proselytise for his, me to say there is no faith. It allows argument. Respect means you've got to shut up. Mm-hmm. There are boundaries which you shouldn't cross. Rushdie can't cross, and when people like Rushdie do cross them, they are punished for failing to show respect.
Mm. I've always liked the H.R. Mencken, the American journalist, had a line, one should respect the other man's religion in the same way you respect his belief that his wife is beautiful and his children intelligent. but even that implies a politeness.
In some sense, I hope I don't go out gratuitously to cause offence, but the struggle for human freedom has been a struggle to say there are some subjects that are too important to allow respect or kid gloves or tongue-biting or any kind of mealy-mouthed approach when approaching them. And religions that claim domination over women's bodies, over the lives of men, over the lives of hundreds of millions of people, that is surely far too important an issue to say, well, you've got to back off from that. I mean, people say, well, the religious get psychic wounds because their religion means so much to them. But there are people listening to this show who are perhaps very, very left-wing. When they hear conservatives mock them and satirise them, they feel the wound. They feel as if their very being is being torn apart. I remember during the Thatcher years, I couldn't bear to hear a Thatcherite conservative on the radio. I mean, it was almost physical revulsion. But we don't censor political arguments out of respect. We don't, and we say states that do, who say you can't talk about political arguments in anything but a respectful way, we call those dictatorships. And we know without needing to be told that people who are doing the censoring are censoring to preserve the power of the ruling elite.
That point that you talk about physical revulsion and ideals, I remember in my day job working for Index on Censorship a few years ago, I had to cover an extradition case for a Holocaust denier called Frederick Tobin.
I
can remember that exact feeling, being sat in the court next to David Irving and Lady Michelle Renouf, and emerging every day feeling shattered by being in the very presence of these people. I mentioned that Holocaust denial thing because we are looking at this year, in the coming weeks, next week in fact, the French government looking at debating whether to ban any discussion on any denial of the Armenian genocide. I think a lot of people would think Holocaust denial, genocide denial, is somewhere where you could draw a line.
No. Look, if you can't beat a Holocaust denier in open argument without feeling the need to call for the cops, you have no business being in public debate in the first place. You should back off and make way for someone who's competent and able to win the argument. You sink to Irving's level, you do that. Irving, who you mentioned rather famously and ridiculously, when an American historian, rather brilliant American historian called Deborah Lipstadt, called him out and said, he's a Holocaust denier, he's this, he's that. He didn't defend freedom of speech. He sued in the British libel courts, a case that cost millions and millions of pounds, which turned on whether the Holocaust really happened and whether the Nazis did it. And finally, a British judge, after wasting £2 million, one Mr Justice Gray, said, well, after hearing all the available evidence and considering everything, I've come to the conclusion these Nazis really were quite bad chaps, you know. jolly, jolly awful, and I think people are entitled to say it. And I say, you know, well, where on earth would the English be without our judges to guide us? If you can't beat a Turk, an official of a Turkish state who says there was no genocide of the Armenians, if you can't beat David Irving in an argument, pack off. Pack up, go home, do something else, and leave it to people who are more confident about freedom of speech and more confident about their ability to use freedom of speech.
People say that we need, society needs to be protected.
Well, yeah, I mean, one of the problems is there's a type of liberal censorship, and this is, I would say, people who believe in Holocaust now, I mean, they think of themselves as a type of liberal, very odd type of liberal, but if they do, on the whole, perhaps I'm overgeneralised, perhaps some conservatives believe as well, on the whole, that basically regards our fellow citizens as just waiting for the right words before they dress up in black leather and invade Poland. You know, I mean, they just think their fellow citizens are proto-Nazis. Or racist or fascist, so we have to censor to save them, to save us and save them from themselves. This argument is just being demolished all over the place. In France, a country which, as you say, for entirely self-interested electoral reasons, there's an Armenian minority in France whose votes increasingly desperate Sarkozy needs, are proposing making it a crime to deny the Armenian genocide. In France, where there's the first country to ban Holocaust denial, has the most ludicrous privacy laws, which means you can't really say anything about the private life of a politician. Has it worked? No. The far-right National Front may well come second in the French presidential election, something unthinkable in Britain. And there are all kinds of complicated reasons. But one of the reasons is people are told there are ideas you can't say. So
really, you don't have the debate.
You don't have the debate. First of all, as John Stuart Mill said, one of the best reasons for allowing freedom of speech is truthful ideas can go into the marketplace, ideas, and vanquish false ideas and be strengthened in the process. But also, you know, somehow these very seedy, very unattractive politicians, Frank Lafferon, there's something of the free speech martyr about it. There's something about they are saying things the establishment don't want us to hear and the past laws not want us to hear. Leaving aside all principled argument, it is hugely counterproductive. It never works, and it betrays something that's not very attractive about European elites, a hangover from the aristocracy of the old regime, that the masses are stupid, that they cannot be trusted with freedom, and our job is to control them and spoon-feed them and tell them what they can and can't think.
I think you touched on something interesting there, the idea of the martyrdom involved in some of these arguments. And it's censorship, modern censorship, seems to come from that idea of being victimised, whereas in the past, as you say, it would have
been... Oh, everyone's a victim these days.
It would have been top-down. It's what I strangely admire about the Belarusian dictator Alexander Lukashenko, is that he is so old school that he doesn't even play the victim card. He just says, I'm right, you're wrong, and you will be crushed.
And also, because it's a former Soviet republic, whereas even Putin has changed the name of the KGB to the FSB, Lukashenko says, no, it's still the KGB. No PR here. It's the KGB. They're as nasty as ever.
People, I think it was Clay Shirky, got terribly optimistic about how the internet was going to change the world and everyone was going to be free within the next god and hell, and cited Belarus as this wonderful example of how the internet is going to set us all free.
Well, Rick, so perhaps I should explain to your audience, because Belarus ought to be a great stain on Europe's consciousness. It ought to be something your listeners know about. It's not. I mean, it's quite hard, as Padraig knows, and I know. Whenever I've written about it, you can, because with the net now, you can map maybe Belarus, you know, hardly anyone reads it. It's the last dictatorship in Europe. It's squashed between Poland and the Russian Federation. And its communist, exposed communist dictatorship kept the dictatorship going, and it persecutes people. And the net, you know, through Index on Censorship, I got to know Belarusian dissidents. Other friends and comrades, I got to know Syrian dissidents. I mean, no one denies the net is the most magnificent thing. They wouldn't. No dissident movement fighting oppression, if they could push a button, abolish the net, would dream of doing it. The trouble is there's a type of utopianism taking hold. I mean, Clay Shirky, very agreeable, interesting writer, but is a classic example of it, who just thinks, well, look, the net guarantees freedom of speech because censors can't censor it. Because you can call online in dictatorships without being censored for people to demonstrate, and the censors don't know who's going to come, you get freedom of assembly, and because you get freedom of assembly, freedom of the press with it, because people can then write up reports of what's happened rather than have the regime silence them, censor the press, or deliver entirely false reports. And this does lead to a kind of very glib, very wide-eyed optimism that all you need is a net, and the old problems go away. And one thing I argue in the book, I'm not one of these people who say the net is not a communications revolution. It is. It may be as important as the invention of the printing press, movable type in the printing press, but it might change the rules, but it doesn't change the game. Because suppose, I don't know, someone in the studio had read a report about a Russian oligarch in London revealing, perhaps unsurprisingly, how he'd made his fortune by criminal method and topping his business rivals.
Not naming any names, yeah.
We'd all read that. And this Russian oligarch was buying British newspapers or giving money to the political party. We'll go, wow. But if you want to do something about it, you have to step out of the wired world and start arguing under your own name in a real piece, in a real country. Yeah. And suddenly you find the net has not abolished, say, the English libel law, which would have you absolutely hammered, even if you were telling the truth. If you step outside in the streets in Syria, you might be able to read all kinds of things about Assad online. The net has not abolished dictatorship, and they will still shoot you if they can. So I say in the book it's a Janus face technology, because it also, of course, gives huge new powers of surveillance to democratic states, dictatorial states, spies, police forces, employers. There was a chap in Manchester, works for Trafford Council, who on his Facebook page, he's a born-again Christian, he doesn't like gays, but he's a free man in a free country, he's entitled to opinion. As I said earlier, you can't beat a homophobe in argument, you've no business being in the argument in the first place. And he said he disapproves of gay marriage, and the council read his Facebook page and demoted him and cut his salary by £14,000. Now, a council couldn't do that 20 years ago. Mm-hmm. Kant's couldn't... Yeah, if this guy had sat at the pub with, well, it was Christian, probably a cafe, sat in the cafe with his friends and said, I don't like this gay marriage, I very disapprove of it, the Bible, Leviticus is, and St. Paul, very clear, clearly anti-homosexual. The council wouldn't have spies going into every bar in South Manchester, in Trafford, South Manchester, listening out for one of their employees say something out of line. In fact, with the net, they can. And we know this. All your listeners know this. Now, they worry about Facebook privacy. They worry about the state collecting information. So it's very, very Janus-faced. Mm-hmm. And you've got to break out of this glib optimism and realise it doesn't alter the needs for practical political struggles for freedom of speech and, you know, in the cases we're talking about, for protections of privacy as well.
I would just say at this stage, anyone listening, this argument is very brilliantly made by Evgeny Morozov, who's a Belarusian and a former guest on Little Atom. So if you want to hear more about this,
love Morozov, though I do dearly. And it's very telling that utopianism comes to people like Clay Shirky, who are Americans, you know, whatever their private lives, have never known suffering, never known foreign invasion, you know, never known dictatorship, while the great counterblast of scepticism comes from Morozov, who's a Belarusian. Yeah, I don't agree with him all the way, because in the end, there's a danger with that you underestimate the net. Mm. And the Arab Spring shows it does have revolutionary potential. But what you need to understand is to have a balanced approach which reaffirms the primacy of politics, which reaffirms the need that if you're under oppressive regime or suffer oppressive laws, as we do in this country, the net can't set you free. Mm-hmm. It may be able to help you in some ways, it may hurt you in other ways, but what is required is collective political action.
It's interesting, well, we're talking about the net, because Julian Assange gets mentioned in your book, and he obviously is seen by quite a few people as a sort of campaigner for free speech and freedom of information, yet he doesn't come out particularly well in your book, particularly in
what
regards
scoundrel.
To Belarus, so I wonder if we could talk about that a little bit.
Well, what happened was, going back to the primacy of politics, the transparency movement talks as if it's above politics, it's beyond politics, for some good reasons. You know, what we do is we just give the information to people. What people do with that information, what you, Richard, and you, Patrick, do with that, that's up to you. You know, we are not responsible. And that can seem quite a high ideal. It is in some ways, you know, anti-corruption cases, knowing what your MPs are, who's lobbying your MPs. That is all very good. But the danger of it is you just put stuff out without taking any responsibility. In journalism, the ethics of journalism, some of your listeners might be surprised to hear that there are ethics in journalism. We have one moral principle, only the one, that's a burden too much, is you never betray a source. Mm. You know, if someone has come to you who's working in the public interest and given you information, and if you reveal his or her name, he or she can lose their job, he or she can go to prison, he or she can die, you know, you burn in hell before you release their name. Assange did was he had these documents of American State Department, who turned out not to be such bad people, really, and all kinds of liberals and dissidents went to see them and talked to them, oppressive regimes, and the State Department officials said, well, you know, Mr. X came to see me, Mrs. Y came to see me. And despite the protests, a lot of good people who work at WikiLeaks, a colleague of mine called James Ball, I think, on The Guardian, worked there, he said, no, I'm just going to print them all. And they said, what? You know, you're doing things like handing a death list to the Taliban. You're doing things like there's an Ethiopian journalist had to go on the run. You're saying to oppressive regimes and totalitarian movements, you're saying, here are all the people who collaborated with the evil Yankee neocon enemy. I mean, you're handing out death sentences. In Belarus's case, he hired an Index on Censorship, a very brilliant work on this. He actually got one of your, a man, I think it's called Israel Shamir, I think it's best called neo-Nazi, certainly a raving, loony anti-Semite, who, on the one hand, as a lot of people on the far left do, on one hand, seemed very far left and supported Belarus because it was nominally communist, on the other hand, seems equally far right because of the anti-Semitism, who just took all the papers to the Belarusian government to persecute friends and comrades of mine and yours. Now, if that's what the new age of transparency means, then the new age of transparency stinks. It's an age without any kind of morals. Even journalists have a higher morality than that. And that's not setting the bar very high.
we've touched a few times. We've skirted around England's libel laws.
Yeah.
And libel and privacy. The book starts quite brilliantly with the idea of how does a woman find out if her husband's having an affair in England in 2011? And the answer is, with a combination of privacy and libel laws, it ain't that easy, is it?
No. Libel, people in the studio have been involved in one of the best campaigns I've been involved in my life to reform the English libel laws, which have just become a source of great shame to this country. In that Russian oligarchs, Ukrainian oligarchs, every kind of rich creep from all over the world comes to London to sue. Everyone from Human Rights Watch in New York to African Democrats to people in Saudi Arabia, who ought to be able to look to Britain as a beacon of liberty, find that Britain is liberty's enemy, and very wealthy men can use the English courts to punish their critics. And because of the net, England can claim sort of extraterritorial jurisdiction, because they can say, even though this article's been printed in Ukraine or Denmark, the fact that it could be read in Britain via the net means England can intervene. And that is...
It might be worth for this explaining what the infamous Duke of Brunswick ruling...
The Duke of Brunswick ruling is... It's a ruling that you just need one site of an article for it to be actionable. So there's no time delay. Normally you say, if something was written 10 years ago, you can't sue now. But the fact, the Duke of Brunswick ruling, you can see it on the net, on an archive net, you can sue now. The Duke of Brunswick was a very unpleasant man. He was a very fat, widely despised German princeling whom the good people of Brunswick threw out in the Revolution of 1830. He moved to Paris, and at the time of the Revolution of 1830, English satirical papers mocked him in far worse terms than saying he's fat and despised. I mean, it was pretty heavy stuff. And so the Duke of Brunswick sent his manservant to the British Library to get an old copy of, I think it was a News Dispatch, that had unflattering remarks about him in. And the manservant produced a paper, and so his lawyers could go to English courts and said, well, the time out hasn't expired on this. I know it was published 10, 20 years ago, but my manservant was able to get this article yesterday. And the obliging judges, instead of saying, don't be so ridiculous, the obliging judges said, yes, that means that this libel has been reprinted, even though the only reason this libel has been reprinted is the Duke sent his servant to get the article in the first place. And that has quite profound implications in the age of the net, when, all my newspaper articles, everything you've ever written, is permanently accessible.
All these podcasts,
yes, be careful.
But I think that is probably where we're going to have to leave it, unfortunately. We could have easily talked for another half hour. But thank you very much, Nick Cohen. You Can't Read This Book is on sale in all good bookshops and some dodgy ones.
Thank you very much.
You've been listening to Little Atoms. You can find details of upcoming guests at our website, littleatoms.com. The Little Atoms podcast is available on iTunes. Thanks for listening.